supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Earlier today, President Trump signed an executive order loosening restrictions on churches and other religious organizations when it comes to political activities. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Dave Heller is off this evening. WHYY's Katie Colinari tells us local faith leaders are divided on whether they'll take advantage of it.
Last summer, Pennsylvania pastor Gary Dull was one of the hundreds of evangelical Christians who filled a ballroom in New York City to hear from candidate Donald Trump. Dull says Trump made a promise to scrap a 60-year-old part of the federal tax code known as the Johnson Amendment, which bars churches and other nonprofits from endorsing or opposing political candidates. If they do, the IRS can take away their tax-exempt status. Dull sees President Trump's executive order today as a promise kept and an opportunity.
My senator in the Pennsylvania State Senate is John Eichelberger. I have gone out in the past as a citizen, and I have endorsed John Eichelberger. I've never done that from my pulpit, but now I would have the freedom as the pastor of the Faith Baptist Church of Altoona to do that from my pulpit without the fear of any kind of governmental oppression.
And do you plan to do that?
Oh, I'm sure that I will. Yes, ma'am.
Only Congress has the authority to repeal the Johnson Amendment, but Trump has essentially ordered the IRS to back off. The last time the IRS actually enforced this law was the mid-90s, but organizations like the Pennsylvania Pastors Network have pushed to repeal it, saying it would strengthen religious freedom. Others say the system already works just fine. J. Lewis Felton is pastor of Mount Airy Church of God in Christ. The church hosted presidential candidate Hillary Clinton just before last fall's election, and Felton endorsed Clinton as a member of a local group of black clergy. But he says even with the protections Trump is offering, he'll never do it from the pulpit.
We preach Christ. I'm never going to get up and preach a judge. I'm not going to preach a president, but I will take a stand on issues. And if that individual who is a candidate can stand with me on those issues, then I think we can work out a partnership.
Philadelphia pastor Allison Cornish believes attaching faith matters to a candidate or elected official under any circumstances can work against an organization's mission. Cornish heads up Pennsylvania Interfaith Power and Light, a coalition of around 50 congregations from several religions that advocates action on climate change.
We really believe that a moral voice, a faith voice on the issues of sustainability, including our planet, but for all people, are nonpartisan issues.
Cornish says talking about these issues in partisan ways will deepen the divides among Americans, not heal them. Katie Colinari, WHYY News.
Today, the House passed the American Health Care Act, a replacement for President Obama's signature legislative achievement, the Affordable Care Act. It did so with the help of a key amendment introduced by Republican Congressman Tom MacArthur of South Jersey. The amendment allows states to apply for waivers to some parts of the health law. MacArthur says the law protects those with pre-existing conditions, an assertion widely disputed by Democrats, while lowering premiums.
The reality is we have to fix a system that is falling apart, and we will make sure that the people that have coverage today don't have the rug pulled out from under them. That's what this bill does. That's what my amendment does.
Speaking shortly before the vote, Democratic Delaware Congressman Lisa Blunt Rochester spoke out against the bill.
Instead of bringing us together, this simply divides us by providing less coverage, imposing an age tax, forcing people to pay more, and stripping key protections.
Democrats voted unanimously against the bill. Republican representatives in the Philadelphia region were among the 20 nationwide who opposed the bill. They included Pat Meehan, Ryan Costello, Charlie Dent, and Brian Fitzpatrick of Pennsylvania. New Jersey Republicans Leonard Lance and Frank Lobiondo also voted against it, while MacArthur voted in favor of it. The bill now moves on to the Senate. The healthcare debate got a shout out from late night host Jimmy Kimmel earlier this week during a tearful monologue about the birth of his son, Billy, last month. Kimmel and his wife received a shock after Billy was born.
They did an echocardiogram, which is a sonogram of the heart, and found that Billy was born with a heart disease, something called tetralogy of Fallot with pulmonary atresia.
Billy was rushed into surgery, what Kimmel calls the most difficult 3 hours of his life, and is thankfully doing okay now. He'll have follow-up surgeries in the coming months and years. Tetralogy of Fallot is a rare condition. Only about 1 in 2,000 to 2,500 babies are born with it, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. We don't normally have reporters on our show about their personal experiences, but this one seemed like too much of a connection to pass up. NewsWorks Tonight producer Shai Ben-Yaakov had a son born with the same condition last August, and he talked about it with Mike and Scott, host of The Pulse.
Shai, what exactly is tetralogy of Fallot?
Well, it's a complex congenital heart condition, but basically it involves a hole between the two ventricles, the two bottom chambers of the heart, so that the blood with oxygen mixes with the blood without oxygen, and basically the baby doesn't get enough oxygen to their body. Also, in a lot of cases, there's limited or no blood flow from the heart to the lungs. And that's a situation called pulmonary atresia, which is what happened to Jimmy Kimmel's son.
When did you find out that your son Amos was affected by this condition?
My wife had a late ultrasound at 36 weeks just to check the size of the baby. And the doctors saw that his aorta didn't look quite right. So we got some more testing done, and they determined that he had tetralogy of Fallot. Fortunately, though, he did not have pulmonary atresia, so he did have a pulmonary artery that was able to get blood out to the lungs.
And this, in the case of your son, turned out to be part of a larger condition, right?
Yeah. When they sat us down and talked about the condition, they said that often the way that his case was manifesting, it's often connected to a genetic condition called 22q. After Amos was born, 2 days later, we had a genetic test done, and it was confirmed that he had 22q. That's a genetic disorder that has a lot of symptoms, but one of the common ones is the heart condition, tetralogy of Fallot.
3 months after Amos was born, he had to have surgery to repair this hole in his heart. So take me to that day of the surgery. What was going on with you? What was going on with your wife, Kate?
So we brought him into the hospital that morning. It was early December. And they took him back pretty quickly. And we got to spend probably 45 minutes with him. We were emotional. We said goodbye. I kissed him on the forehead, and they took him back to the operating room. It was emotional.
Yeah. How long was he in surgery, and where were you during that time? You can't be in the operating room.
No, they took us to a waiting area, and we were there for a total of about 4 hours. Every hour, we had a nurse come in and update us on what was happening, where they were with the surgery. You know, after 1 hour, it was basically, we've done all the prep work and we're ready to make the incision. At 2 hours, I think she came in and said, well, they're finished with part of the surgery, but they need to take him off of, he was on a bypass machine. They need to take him off of bypass and make sure that everything is working okay. Before I knew it, they're very, very good at this. You know, before I knew it, they were basically finished, and we were being ushered into a different room to go see him.
So once you reunited with Amos, what was that like?
That was also emotional. He had this big white patch on his chest, and he had all kinds of tubes coming out of his chest. He had what's called a CPAP that was sort of forcing oxygen up into his nose.
And he's a little guy.
Yeah, he was such a little guy. And I remember that his cry sounded really, really hoarse. You know, he was sort of just groggy and obviously didn't know what was going on. And I kind of wanted to pick him up and make it better.
Yeah. How is Amos now?
So Amos is doing great. He's 8 months old now. For the first couple months after the surgery, he wasn't able to be on his stomach. But after that period of time was over, he was able to roll over. He can now, you know, sit up, and he's eating solid foods, and he's babbling, and he's putting everything in his mouth. because of his genetic condition, 22q, he's going to face some other challenges in his life. But thankfully, at this point, he is relatively healthy.
I don't want to put a price on, obviously, what happened and the beauty of this success, but I do want to know, what did this cost?
Yeah, we did get an invoice that was just sort of the total amount that went to the insurance company, not the amount we were supposed to pay. And I don't remember the exact figure, but it was something crazy like $170,000. And I don't know how much we paid total for this. I think maybe insurance had us pay about $1,200 total for the hospital visit. I can't imagine being faced with having to make a decision about saving my son's life and thinking about the cost of it. That just never entered into it for us, fortunately, thank God.
It sounds like it was stressful enough as it was.
It was plenty stressful.
I'm glad Amos is doing better. Shai, thank you so much.
Thank you, Maiken.
That's NewsWorks Tonight producer Shai Ben-Yakov talking with Maiken Scott, host of WHYY's The Pulse. Attempts to racially integrate schools in America have prompted such backlash and animosity that at this point the idea has been largely abandoned. And schools today are considered more segregated than they were in 1968, not long after the landmark Brown versus Board of Education ruling ended racial separation by mandate. Based on its legacy of slavery and racism, this is, in a way, a uniquely American problem, but the underpinnings of the issue are truly universal. Keystone Crossroads education reporter Kevin McCrory went to Berlin, Germany, to explore that city's recent integration effort.
Good morning, good morning, good morning to you.
Berlin's Venita Elementary is a beautiful school. It has clean, orderly hallways, brightly lit classrooms with huge windows, up-to-date technology, and moderately sized student-teacher ratios. But a stigma hangs over the school. Katrin Baumhofer is principal.
All around us is social housing. All parents are entitled to social assistance, meaning they're getting money from the state.
Venita is located in Wedding, a neighborhood in Berlin with some of the city's highest levels of poverty, unemployment, and Turkish and Arabic-speaking immigrants. But the neighborhood abuts a much wealthier section of the city, and a dividing line thought of as a social wall runs exactly along the site of the former Berlin Wall.
Parents from the wealthy side are always very enthusiastic about how beautiful and quiet this school is. And then they see so many brown eyes, headscarves, and long hair and all that. And then those parents say, that's not us.
This social wall exists within Mitte, the central district in Berlin. About a decade ago, the government came up with a plan to integrate the schools. They felt they could give kids born into poverty a better chance at upward mobility by mixing them with students higher up the socioeconomic ladder. All over Mitte, the government put schools into clusters, where, in theory, parents could opt for any school in their zone. The most contentious zone was the one drawn around this social wall, near Venita, which included three schools on the poor side of the divide and four on the wealthy side. In practice, though, the exercise ultimately served to show how those with greater agency pull the levers of power.
If parents don't get a place, then they have the possibility to appeal.
Angela Thiele is the principal of Koppenplatz Elementary, one of the schools on the wealthier side. And if the appeal didn't work?
Some go to a private school and some move to another district.
Similar to the so-called white flight that occurred in many U.S. cities in the 1970s and 80s due to desegregation busing, German parents of greater means either opted for private school or moved to another section of the city. Or they hired a lawyer.
You want to make a sound check?
Could you put this on your lapel?
Yeah. Attorney Olaf Werner represented dozens of parents fighting school placements. He says the most effective legal argument was a simple one.
Then you use a procedural argument, saying the whole area is much too large.
Over and over again, Werner was successful arguing that elementary school children shouldn't have to travel further than necessary to get to school. For context, schools that straddle either side of the social wall are as little as a half mile apart.
At the beginning, you are also angry on the families.
Maya Lasic is a member of Berlin's parliament.
Because they have an extreme focus on their own interest and are not even willing to try.
The city of Berlin, steeped in pivotal 20th century history, provides an almost poetic backdrop to the school integration debate.
The free passage of people between East and West Berlin was the only physical gap in the Iron Curtain. So the Russians sealed it. The wall is a solid fact.
Arguments for creating fairer, more equitable school systems can veer towards the ideals of socialism, prioritizing the good of the whole over individual desire. But as decades of history proved in Soviet-controlled East Berlin, this sort of system can be extremely stifling. Here, it came to the point that government literally built a wall to keep its people in. So it's little wonder that parents of greater means try to escape anything that they perceive will limit the opportunities of their children. And that goes even for those parents who hold a very liberal worldview.
We pay a lot of taxes, but we like to do that because, I mean, that's something which is really, I think, for the social well-being.
Anke Krause sends her two daughters to Koppenplatz. Many of her friends send their kids to private school. And she says she probably would have done the same if the integration plan forced her kids outside her neighborhood.
I think we still have the borders and the things in our heads and in our hearts, and there's a lot of, how that works.
In the end, after dealing with years of complaints and legal challenges, the Mitte government abandoned the integration plan.
Was war für eine Ausstellung?
Alice im Wunderland?
Okay.
To some, though, Bilder? Like vetting parent Andreas Rissmann, Bilder. The pushback that killed the integration effort is alarming.
My parents have taught us tolerance. They had no prejudices against anything. That's what we learned from them.
Rissmann takes his cue from another period in Berlin's history. His grandfather fought for the Nazis in World War II. And as a backlash, his parents raised him to be extra sensitive and open to any differences between people. So as much as he values personal choice, he worries about what this says about human nature.
Für mich ist jeder Mensch gleich.
For me, everybody's equal, no matter where they're from, which language they speak. If with one arm, three heads, I don't mind either way.
Kevin McCrory, Keystone Crossroads.
And tomorrow we examine a school along the social wall where integration has occurred, but only with the help of a hotly debated special program. William Eckenbarger is a former journalist for the Philadelphia Inquirer and author whose new book is Pennsylvania Stories Well Told, published by Temple University Press. It's a collection of a number of Eckenbarger's articles about the Keystone State, ranging from the story of Mock Chunk, a.k.a. Jim Thorpe, to the history of the pencil, John Updike, and much more. Bill Eckenbarger, welcome to Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So let's get a sketch of a couple of the stories. Pennsylvanians are familiar with U.S. Senator Bob Casey, but many of us also remember his father, former Pennsylvania Governor Bob Casey, who suffered a serious illness which required a double organ transplant. But really, this is the story of two men. And as you write, of a Saturday night in the early 1990s, two women sat beside hospital beds 2 miles apart, inextricably linked by grief and hope. Tell us more about that.
Well, the first woman was the mother of a man named Michael Lucas, who was about 33 years old, and he was beaten to death in a drug deal. The other woman was Bob Casey's wife, Ellen, and he was next to dying and urgently awaiting a heart and liver transplant. And at some point, Mike Lucas's mother concluded that he was not going to survive, so she authorized the hospital to turn off life support, and his organs were, as they say, harvested and taken over to Bob Casey.
This is about 25 years ago, and health insurance, health coverage is an issue back then, as it is now. You know, Bob Casey, of course, was the governor, and he had what you called the wallet biopsy. What is that?
He had a gilt-ed health care coverage through the state. It paid for the entire operation. Unfortunately, transplants are so expensive, and probably not many people's health insurance covers something like that. I know mine doesn't. So you either have to raise money, which people actually hold fundraising drives to raise money to do it. But that's what the wallet biopsy is.
And as you point out in your book, had the tables been turned, Mike Lucas would not have gotten the transplant.
Exactly.
Bill, do you have a favorite story in this book?
Probably my favorite story is I got to interview John Updike, the famous novelist and poet from Berks County. I pitched a story to the magazine about doing a story about the places in Berks County that he mentions in his novels. I contacted his publisher, and they turned me down for an interview. So I went to the Shillington Library, which is hometown, and I asked the librarian, did she have any material on John Updike? And this older woman came over to me, and she said, I know about him. He's my son. I took her to lunch, and we talked. And then she took me to the farmhouse where he spent his adolescence, and she showed me his room. And so I went back, and I started to write, and she called me about a week later, and she said, why don't you come back? He's here to put my storm windows in, as he does every year. So I drove there, and Updike was there. He was a little miffed at first, but then he got in my car and he said, I'll drive so you can take notes. So we drove around a little bit, and I see he was really starting to warm to this whole thing. He was talking about, here's where I did this and here's where I heard about this. And when I got back, I had this really great story. About 6 months later, I got a call from Art Carey, my editor at the Inquirer, and he said, have you seen the current New Yorker? So I got it, and there is a short story in there by John Updike entitled One More Interview. And in the short story, it's a musician rather than a writer, but it's a musician comes back to his hometown and is interviewed by a reporter. And some of the dialogue is word for word from our conversation. At first, I didn't know what to think, but then I realized that I can in some way consider myself a muse to John Updike.
Well, what goes into the writing of a well-told story, in your opinion?
The way I put it is you gather 10 times as much information as you need. You pick out the best 1 in 10 of the information, and then you spend about 2 weeks writing it very slowly.
Is it a challenge for you to have those words appear on the word processor?
Every time I sit down at the word processor, I don't think I can do it. So, still.
Well, William Eckenberger, thank you so much for joining us on News Works tonight.
Thank you.
William Eckenberger's book is called Pennsylvania Stories, Well Told. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shaiban Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan for NewsWorks Tonight.